WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Miami has one of the highest crime rates in the country, and my guest Edna Buchanan has been on the scene of many of those crimes. For 15 years, Buchanan has been the crime reporter for the Miami Herald. There are policemen in Miami who say a murder wouldn't be a murder without her there. In 1986, Buchanan won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting. In a profile of her in the New Yorker magazine last year, Calvin Trillin credited her with elevating the prose of crime reporting to a new level. The classic Edna lead, as he calls it, was a first paragraph that began like this. The man she loved slapped her face. Furious, she says she told him never ever to do that again. "What are you going to do, kill me?" he asked, and handed her a gun. "Here, kill me," he challenged. She did. Edna Buchanan describes the crimes she's covered and the deadlines she's met in her new book, The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. Edna Buchanan, welcome to Fresh
Air.
Thank
you.
You know, for a lot of people, crime reporting is the place where you start, like the obituary page in a newspaper, and then you pay your dues and you move out into city politics or a foreign beat or something like that. You've stayed with it for 15 years. It seems to be your calling. What do you love about it?
Well, it's the nitty-gritty. It's what makes people become heroes or homicidal maniacs. It's got everything. Sex, greed, violence, comedy, tragedy. You can't learn as much about people on any other newspaper beat.
A lot of people think of the crime stories that you read as either ghoulish or voyeuristic or superficial. You know, just the crime stories. We want to hear the real news.
But that isn't true. A lot of people claim that they don't read crime stories, but they really do. They're the best read stories in the paper. Once the Herald commissioned this survey of cross-section of readers, and they interviewed them and had editors and psychiatrists watching from behind a glass, and all the people said, oh, no, they thought it was too much crime news. They didn't like crime news. And yet, when they asked them what name at the Herald they recognized, they all sat and thought a minute, and then simultaneously, three out of the four said Edna Buchanan. So how did they notice that name if they weren't reading the stories? So people do want to read about it because it is basics.
I think that the beat is mostly a man's world. Most of the crime reporters traditionally have been men. Most cops traditionally have been men. Detectives traditionally have been men. When you started on the beat, did you have to act extra tough to prove yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, back then there were very few women ever sent out to cover crime stories. I was usually out there with almost exclusively other male reporters. But now when I go out to cover a crime in Miami, there are many other women out there covering crime. And I think editors have realized that a woman can cover crime in the streets as well, if not better than a man.
Early on, did your being a woman ever bring out the protective instincts of the male cops or detectives?
Occasionally, but more often, I think they would try to gross me out, you know, show me terrible crime scene pictures or a terrible crime scene or a report of some terrible sexual crime or something, seeing if it would have an effect on me. And of course, even if it did, they never saw it.
You once exploited the fact that you were a woman. It was a story about a torture chamber in somebody's basement, and all the reporters were lined up. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, it was Albert Brust who had kidnapped a teenage couple, a boy and a girl, took him back to his house. He killed the boy, shot him, and then decapitated him and cemented his body into the bathtub to cover it up. And he eventually, he raped and tortured the girl, eventually let her go, took her to Fort Lauderdale. She went directly to the police and told her story, and they didn't believe a word she said and sent her back home. And meanwhile, Brust, who'd been an immaculate housekeeper, had miscalculated. The cement didn't seal. The body began to decompose, and this terrible-smelling, you know, stuff, you know, the odor permeated the house. So the answer would have to be using a jackhammer to excavate the body, you know, a messy job. And then, of course, it would have to be disposed of elsewhere. So Brust took the easy way out. He committed suicide in his backyard, drank a milkshake laced with cyanide. And the police, a young housewife next door, finally noticed that her neighbor hadn't moved in 2 days and called the police. And they thought at first that it was a routine suicide. And then, of course, they found something terrible rotting away under the cement in the bathtub. And this torture chamber in the house was soundproofed and padded, you know, the doors and the windows. So I was out there with all these other reporters waiting for the police to tell us what they had there inside. They were all men, you know, radio, TV, news service, you know, and other print journalists. And the lieutenant finally came out, and he said he would take the reporters in one at a time for a tour of the house and the torture chamber for our stories. I was pushing deadline. I had to still drive all the way back downtown to the Herald to file my story. So without thinking, in desperation, I yelled, "Ladies first." And I got to go first and filed the nation's first story on this classic case of murder and madness. And I thought later on the way back to the Herald, was that being sexist, you know, which is bad, or aggressive, which is considered good in this business? I think there's a fine line, and that's as close as I've come to it.
Did the male reporters realize that it was you, their competition, who had yelled out "ladies first"?
Well, you know, obviously.
You were the only lady
they
there.
They did, yeah. And at the time, they didn't resent it. It sort of took them by surprise. Maybe today that wouldn't go over so easily, but at that time it did.
My guest is the Miami Herald's Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter, and she's written a new book titled "The Corpse Had a Familiar Face." What was the first time you saw a corpse while covering the beat?
That was years and years ago when I worked for a smaller paper, the Miami Beach Sun, and it was a young man who was sort of known, well-known around the beach, who was shot in a barroom brawl. And I got there, it was just after dawn, the bars close around 5 a.m., and this happened at closing time. And he was just sprawled there on the sidewalk in front of this local bar. And the police were looking for the killer, someone he'd argued with inside.
Was it hard to take the first time you saw a corpse? You've seen, what, 5,000 now, according to your book.
Well, I've covered 5,000 violent deaths. But this, you would have thought that it might be. I had never seen a dead body that fresh before, out, you know, exposed and, you know, newly dead. But it wasn't hard to take because you become very curious. You know, you want to know what happened, who was he, what kind of bullet made that neat little hole, and could he have been saved, what was in his pockets, what happened, what caused all this, why? You know, who is he, what happened, and why did it happen?
There's a great tradition of crime writing in America, and a lot of that comes from crime fiction, detective novels, and police procedurals. Do you like that kind of writing, and do you feel that you're going for that kind of writing in your coverage?
I don't know. I do like to read some of those writers. I like Donald Westlake, you know, his wonderful black comedy. And I like, there's a series of police procedurals written in Swedish that have been translated to English, Per Wallju and Madge Lindahl. And I love to read those because it's so fascinating to see how universal police problems are. The police in Sweden bitch and complain and moan and gripe about the same things that the police in Miami and the police in Chicago and the police in Philadelphia gripe about. It's fascinating how universal all their problems are. The cop in Moscow today, faced with a murder scene, is doing the same things that a policeman in Miami with a murder scene is doing.
In your book, you write that nobody loves a crime reporter. Nobody loves a police reporter. Why?
It's true, because we're often considered unwelcome intruders. It's human nature. Somebody gets himself in trouble, and then when you report it, he turns on you like it's your fault, not his, that he's in this mess. And, you know, the Greeks used to kill the messenger who brought the bad news, and that attitude survives today. Many people would be delighted to revive the custom.
Are you considered a snoop, too, by the police who are trying to keep certain things cordoned off?
Yeah, they sort of they have this us and them attitude, and they resent outsiders. That's why I like often to make it clear to them that I live in Miami, I love Miami, I care about justice. The people I care about live there, so I wouldn't do anything to hurt a case or to thwart justice in any way. In fact, I may care more than they do because I live there and pay taxes, and most of the police officers in Dade County live across the county line in Broward.
You've lived in Miami for how long now?
Oh, about 25 years.
Now, when you started in Miami, when you moved to Miami, it was still known mostly for the resort hotels and the beaches, and now it's known also for its crime rate and for its drug trafficking. What were the first signs to you as a reporter that the crime rate was really going up and that the murder rate was on the rise? Were there early warning signs about that?
Well, I guess so. When I first arrived, it was sort of a sleepy southern city, a resort area that was sort of, you know, in the off season, it was quiet, things would shut down. And now, of course, it's an exotic international capital. I mean, Miami is Casablanca. And I think back then, you know, we'd have the occasional rape murder and the domestics where people who love each other wind up killing each other and the armed robberies. And now, of course, we have all of them and we have the drug traffic, which accounts for about half of the homicides and a good half of the crime that we have, if not more. And I think that, you know, the drugs started out with heroin, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, and then that leveled off and it began to build. And then, of course, there was the cocaine traffic, and then, of course, the Mariel boat lift. And we began to break all records then for violence.
You describe how five narcotics officers were shot right outside of a very posh hotel, and that people in Miami have become so blasé about crime, so used to it, that nobody moved, nobody paid much attention to this, and that people thought it was a shoot from Miami Vice. And to tell you the truth, when I read that in your book, I couldn't tell whether you were kidding or not. I couldn't tell if that was an exaggeration
or
not.
The police officers were all shot, so was an informant, and it wasn't so much that they were blasé about crime. They really just thought it was Miami Vice shooting again, because Miami Vice shoots, you know, all over the beach, all over, you know, Miami. And, you know, they heard screaming, yelling, shooting, running, police, and they just thought it was Miami Vice. And so nobody hit the floor except the police, who knew they were in trouble. So, you know, it is interesting, because in Miami now, it's so fascinating with Miami Vice, because you sort of see, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, and yet life is imitating art, and all these things are happening. And there was one occasion when a Miami Vice show had featured this sort of night spot that was called the Sex Club, and they were doing these sort of simulated sex acts on stage. And I joked about it the next day with a policewoman, and I said, gee, tourists from the Midwest are going to come here, and they're going to get off the plane and tell the cab driver, take me to the sex club, and there is no such place. But all these places, these incredible discos and these smoky places, and, you know, in the sex club that you see in Miami Vice, soon after, they appear. They're really there. You know, Miami Vice is sort of doing its own sort of urban renewal in Miami Beach. They're painting up old hotels because they're going to shoot there, and they leave them painted beautifully with murals and old gas stations they're refurbishing and using when they shoot. And sure enough, about 6 weeks later, a new club opened, and it was pretty similar to the sex club. You know, it's fascinating. Miami's a very lively place right now.
Have you ever been consulted by any of the script writers from Miami Vice?
Nope, have never heard a thing from them, although I know they sort of raid our files, I guess, and of course the police files, because many of the things that you see in Miami Vice are sort of based on things that really have happened in Miami.
You've had to cover a lot of drug crime being based in Miami, and I think you learn things covering this that nobody else would know. I mean, I certainly hadn't heard of these things. For instance, that one of the techniques of trying to cross borders with cocaine is to pack cocaine into a condom and swallow the condom?
Right. Condoms are balloons. And some of these people find out the hard way what smart women have known for years, you know, that condoms aren't fail-safe. And when they start to leak and that gets into the digestive system, you know, the cocaine begins to leak out. It paralyzes the digestive system. There's no way to get that cocaine out except through surgery, and it will kill you pretty quick. A lot of people have died after the first few came into the hospitals and the medical examiner's offices, and they realized what it was. Now the doctors can save them if they get in there fast enough, because now they know what to look for and to quickly operate and get the stuff out. But some of them, I'm sure, have made it through, and others just didn't and died on the spot. I think I wrote in the one story that the man's last meal was worth $30,000, and it killed him. He had $30,000 worth of cocaine in his intestines when they opened the body for autopsy. I wonder if a lot of these people who think cocaine is fun realize how it sometimes gets to this country.
Well, it's really fascinating the extremes that people will go through for drug trafficking.
Yeah, it's big bucks. It's big money. And that big money corrupts.
It sounds very naive of me to say that. It's amazing the extremes people will go through for drugs. But really, swallowing balloons of cocaine, what a really remarkable thing to try. I remember a line from the movie Scarface, in which the drug kingpin says to the Scarface character, never get high on your own supply. Have you found in your crime reporting that that really is a problem, that when people start tapping into the drugs, when they start using the drugs that they're selling, that it's their downfall?
Exactly, for sure. Because what happens is they wind up using their own stuff, and then they sort of fall into this cocaine paranoia, and they become highly suspicious of the people around them, and that's what causes a lot of these drug murders. They become suspicious of Confederates, accomplices, relatives, neighbors, and they become so paranoid they wind up killing them. Their judgment is you know, really faulty, and they're more apt to pull the trigger. They get very violent. And so that's what causes a lot of these people, these cocaine kingpins, so to speak, to wind up in these major shootouts.
Do you ever feel that you can go into a restaurant or hotel and visually identify who the drug dealers probably are?
Sure.
How?
Oh, their Rolex watches, the bulges in their clothes. They carry purses, a lot of them. And men's purses have somewhat come into vogue, but a lot of them carry it because they have a weapon in there.
Ooh.
And a lot of times you'll see somebody with a coat on, and you have a, you know they've got a long gun. And, and the cars they drive, you know, there are a lot of these people. And it's interesting, in the beginning you would see these cocaine cowboys who just weeks earlier had been back in Colombia or someplace in their own backward country in the mountains riding horseback, and then they wind up in the employ of one of these cocaine kingpins. And here they are in Miami driving these Audis and Mercedes around with high-powered weaponry. And they would just shoot anybody that got in their way. They were just wild, ruthless, crazy cowboys. And after a while, when they got into these broad daylight shootings in shopping centers, they began to realize that it was causing them a lot of grief PR-wise, and they became a little bit more subtle because of the publicity. But they were pretty dangerous people. They would indulge in major shootouts on the turnpike, shooting it from passing cars at each other with machine guns in broad daylight.
Do a lot of these guys know who you are? And if they see you in a restaurant, do you feel like leaving? Because they might feel like you're on their case.
I don't think so. I've had some informants, you know, some sources who were on the witness protection plan or involved in drugs. But I don't think so. I think I'm probably the least of their worries. I mean, they're out there in their own, immersed in their little own cocaine wars, their drug wars, trying to elude the feds and the local police and everybody else.
My guest is Edna Buchanan. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 1986 for her crime reporting for the Miami Herald. She's written a book about her work. It's called The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. We're going to talk a little bit more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Miami crime reporter Edna Buchanan is my guest. Have you ever felt endangered while covering a story?
Only afterwards, and then
afterwards,
it's
thinking
too late.
Back about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, thinking back, gee, this or that could have happened. Because when you're on deadline, you know, deadline is just coming at you like an avalanche. You know, you can't stop it, and you're just thinking about that and getting your story done, and you don't have time for these little incidental things that have no bearing on your story, and so you just tend to brush them aside. And two men tried to rob me once when I left, as I was leaving a crime scene, and I just sort of escaped and got back to the Herald, wrote my story, turned it in, and then thought about it later and thought, gee, I ought to report those guys to the police, you know, and then did belatedly, you know, retroactive, you know, it sort of hit you. But even then, you can't worry about it because you're looking at the next deadline, you know, for the next edition or the next day, and so you never really have time to fret about it. And once I nearly fell into the street on fire when a plane had crashed. A cargo plane loaded with Christmas trees. The load shifted as the plane took off, and the plane veered and crashed into a street in downtown Miami. And the street was on fire because of the jet fuel. The crew was killed, and then it hit an apartment house, which caught fire, killed some people in the apartment house. And I was out there, and I climbed up onto this third floor balcony to get a better look, and there were some homicide detectives up there too. And I had to do a diagram. My editors wanted a diagram of the exact path of the plane, which streets that it came down before finally coming to rest. And so I was leaning over the balcony trying to get a better view, and I said to this homicide detective, "What is that street?" And as I was saying it, the railing buckled and I began to pitch forward. Now I would have just fallen down to the street that was on fire below. And this quick, you know, reacting homicide detective grabbed me by my belt from behind and pulled me back up. And you know, and of course, he was just really shaken. He was trembling all over. And as he pulled me back up, I finished the sentence, said, "Over there, you know, what is that street? Over there." And he said, "You're crazy. You know, you almost got killed." And he was all upset and, you know, shaky. And I sort of forgot about it, finished getting my diagram, worked on the story, you know, around the clock until, you know, the latest deadline, got the story in, and sort of forgot about that and didn't remember it again until I went to the police station a day or two later. And he went into this big tirade again and, you know, how I'd almost been killed and he'd saved my life and he was telling everybody about it. And it didn't even really occur to me at the time because I just had to get that diagram. I had to get it from my editors. I had to find out how many people had been killed. And you're so intent on the story, on that goal, that nothing else really gets in your way. It's like being obsessed. You're just looking down a tunnel and to that light, which is your deadline and your story, and you've got to do what you have to do.
I think another thing that you're really concerned with is being first with whatever story you're covering. And it's hard to do because it's in some ways easier for TV to cover because they can just...
Sure, the immediacy.
They can just like run back in and get on the air, whereas you have to write it up and it has to go to press before your story is officially out. What are some of the ways that you make sure you have the story before anybody else does? Not only in getting back to the paper first, but in making sure you have the information before your competitors do.
Well, it's hard. Each story is different.
It's different, yeah.
But you have to be sort of unobtrusive and just go about your business and work fast and not make a lot of noise that will attract the other media, make them aware of what you're doing. And you just have to really get out there and work.
Do you make a series of phone calls every day to...
And I listen to the scanner before I go to work so I sort of know what's going on and if there's any scenes to go out to directly or if I should just go to the police stations and see what's happening there. And you just go out and beat the bushes and you really work. And then what sort of ticks me off sometimes is the TV and radio people get upset and they say... they go after the police and say, how come she had that story and we didn't? And they're sitting there in their air-conditioned offices waiting for the press release. And then they're angry that we have a story that I went out and worked all night and beat the bushes and scoured a neighborhood to get. And so often the police will say, well, wait a minute. When I go to them finally for confirmation before I put the story in the paper, they say, well, wait a minute. You know, if we tell you about this, we better put out a press release when I'm the one that's really worked out there and unearthed the information. So it's a constant battle because there are a lot of these people who just want to wait for the handout, but then they get incensed if you beat them.
I'm glad you mentioned the handout and the police press releases. You do a good job making fun of them in your book about the really impenetrable language that you find in the police press releases.
Yeah, it's like trying to translate a foreign language into English. You know, and it's funny because police speak in a very colorful fashion ordinarily, and yet they write, you know, that the subject, you know, left the dwelling and proceeded in an easterly direction in a, you know, late model, you know, light color vehicle. So you don't know if vehicle, you know, if that means a car or a pickup truck or whatever. You don't know if the dwelling is a condo or a, you know, a trailer or an apartment house or a private home. You don't know if the subject that they're talking about is male, female, old, young. You know, they can really drive you crazy.
That's an odd thing.
And they always say weapon or firearm. They don't say 38 caliber snub nose or something, you know. And they could, but they just somehow speak in this strange jargon, which any reporter, you know, who uses it is guilty of a second-degree misdemeanor because you really shouldn't allow that to creep into your copy. It's not good.
You also make it clear that you mistrust a lot of editors. What are some of the reasons?
Well, editors can burn your sources.
How would they ruin a source for you?
Well, if an editor, you just turn in your story and go home. And if you do that, it's like sending out your teenage daughter on a date with Theodore Bundy because, you know, you just can't do that because an editor will somehow decide he wants to change this or that. It could be something that makes your source irate or even exposes your source. He can decide to drop a mistake in there, or he can put a headline on it that doesn't make sense, or decide he wants to change the lead and wind up putting a mistake in it. Or he can, you know, there's so many bad things an editor can do to your story. He can take out a first reference to someone, so you really look stupid. There's only a second reference in there without a first name or a title. And so you've got to look over their shoulder. You've got to sort of mother hen your stories. You've got to always stay on it and make sure that they check with you before they change anything. If something has to be shortened, you'll do it together if need be over the telephone, but take your carbons home and your copies home, your printouts, and stay on top of it. I can't walk away.
A lot of people who live in cities are very worried about crime because crime rates in cities tend to be high. Miami is especially high. And you are so cognizant of crime because you're covering it all the time. Now, it sounds like you're so obsessed with deadlines that you don't worry about the possibility of being victimized, but is this in back of your mind because you're so aware of all the crime that there is in the city that you live?
Yeah, I try to stay alert and be careful because I know what can happen out there.
What are some of the things that you've learned? You've probably picked up a lot of tips from the police who you work with about things to watch out for so that you don't... So that you'll notice someone before they commit a crime against you.
Yeah. Well, and yet, you know, Miami is so beautiful. And people come down there and they want to sort of retire and relax and just sort of stroll along dreamily in the sunshine and daydream. And you can't. You know, you have to be alert at all times. Your body language says a lot. If you're not feeling well, you're just sort of shuffling or you're looking vulnerable, you know, then you are more vulnerable. Because, you know, studies and such have shown that often these perpetrators will pick out somebody just by virtue of body language, or if you just sort of look bewildered or dazed or like you don't quite know where you're going. When you're out there on the street, you have to walk sort of purposely and look like you know where you're going. Even if you don't feel well, try to look strong and tough and like, you know. And if somebody approaches you, sort of look them in the eye. Don't sort of try to, you know, sidle away, but look them in the eye. Look them straight in the eye. They don't like that. You have to lock your car doors. Be careful when you're approaching an intersection. If you see somebody you don't like there, you may have to run a red light, but do it if you can do it safely.
I'm going to ask you quickly. Now, you have shoulder-length hair that's very, it's a very kind of windblown type of hairdo, very full, very thick, down to your shoulders. Is that hairstyle, does it call attention to you at all? It's a very, quote, feminine kind of hairstyle?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know. I know that a lot of people recognize me by sight that I deal with on the job. I don't know if, I don't think I'm deliberately trying to call attention to myself.
But when you're on the beat, do you try to wear like tough looking clothes, anything like that?
No, it was interesting. The first few years I worked for the Herald, I sort of always wore dresses because I was very aware of representing the Herald. But then after slogging through the Everglades and riding on airboats in high heels, usually now I wear slacks and comfortable shoes and a nice blouse or something.
Edna Buchanan, I want to thank you very much for telling us about your work. It's been interesting to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you.
My guest has been Edna Buchanan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter for the Miami Herald. Her new book is titled The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.